the headlines. The Yemeni army successfully counters attacks by the Saudi-led coalition on the strategic city of Harat, inflicting heavy losses on the enemy. The majority of Iranian lawmakers urged the government not to clinch an agreement in Vienna without receiving necessary guarantees. And Britain accuses Russia of planning the biggest war in Europe in decades, while Moscow says the talk of war is provocative and can have adverse consequences. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army says it has thwarted an attack by the Saudi-led coalition on the strategic city of Harat, inflicting heavy losses on the enemy. In a tweet, army spokesman Yahya Sari denied allegations that the Saudi-led coalition had taken control of the northwestern city in Hajar governorate. The Yemeni army says a mountainous area was also liberated. It says that as a result, some 200 Saudi forces and mercenaries were killed, and almost double that number were injured. The army added over 40 armored and military vehicles were also destroyed, while two spy drones were shot down. The army is confronting the Saudi-led coalition forces and their loyalists on several fronts inside Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali is a correspondent who joins us from Sana'a. So tell us about this particular area that we just covered in the news, which is something that was liberated in this area by the name of Harad. And I'm understanding that this is part of a wider military operation by the Yemeni army. If you can then fill us in on that, if you have that information.
Thank you so much. Harad is located on the borders between the Yemeni and the Saudi territories. It is very strategic for the Saudis to protect the lands from Yemeni attacks. Actually, the Yemeni army did not escalate the military operations in that particular area, but it was escalated by the Saudi coalition's forces, and there they brought Sudanese, Saudis, Saudi brigades, and also Yemeni mercenaries to fight the Yemeni army in there. They managed to besiege the area in Harad, but the Yemeni army managed to break the blockade imposed on that area and liberated the area from two lines. The Yemeni army recaptured further lands and territories even before the recent escalation was launched by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army is only defending the Yemeni lands, but now they are advancing towards Saudi territories and taking control of new Saudi territories. The Yemeni army says these areas are actually our Yemeni territories, and the Riyadh agreement, the Al-Taif agreement, which was assigned decades ago, it will now be reconsidered by the Yemeni government to see which lands are belonging to the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army is only defending the Yemeni lands. They did not escalate the operations in Harad, but it was escalated by the Saudi coalition forces, maybe to push the Yemeni army to stop attacking Marib. The Yemeni army is determined to liberate the city of Marib. They are encircling now the city, and they have been encircling the city for a few months now, but you know that they didn't want to attack the civilians inside the city. They want only to force the forces inside the city to leave the areas in there, and I believe the Yemeni army will manage to do this even if it take maybe a little bit longer time. But you know, the Yemeni army is doing the operations inside Yemeni territories, and no one can stop the Yemeni army from doing this. They are defending the rights of the Yemeni people. They are attacking mercenaries who are affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, and also Saudis and Sudanese. So the Yemeni army is doing the right thing, people, he say.
Thank you very much for that. Abdul Latif Al-Washali there from Sana'a. Iranian lawmakers have sent a letter to President Ebrahim Raisi setting out several conditions for an agreement to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Some 250 MPs signed the letter. They said the Iranian nation's interests are a red line, calling on the administration to strike no deal without securing necessary guarantees. The lawmakers urged the U.S. and the European parties to the JCPOA to provide guarantees for two issues. They will neither abandon the deal nor trigger the so-called snapback mechanism that could return sanctions on Iran. The U.S. and the Europeans were also urged to remove sanctions imposed under bogus pretexts from nuclear to human rights issues. As for sequencing, the MP said the West should implement its commitments first. Iran will only fulfill its side of the bargain after verifying the measures and a green light from Parliament. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 agreement, meanwhile, are engaged in intense negotiations aimed at reviving the landmark accord. Now Iran's foreign minister says it is time for the U.S. and the European side to show that they are willing to reach an agreement by making political decisions quickly. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comments in a meeting with the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, and the EU coordinator in the Vienna talks, Enrique Mora. The Iranian said that, said had it not been for Iran's initiatives, the sides would not be as close to the deal as they are now. But he insisted that Tehran's red lines will be in place. Earlier in an interview with CNN, Amir Abdollahian said the West, the United States in particular, is responsible for a possible failure of the talks.
Now we are at a very sensitive time, and the other side should be realistic. And if the talks fail, we believe that it is the Americans and the other side that are responsible for it. And the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown its seriousness and has shown that it really wants the deal to be done.
According to the top diplomat, Iran's demands, including a verifiable removal of all sanctions that are inconsistent with the 2015 agreement, as well as the guarantees it's seeking for the fulfillment of commitments by other parties, are absolutely reasonable. The eighth round of negotiations to restore the deal is underway in Austria's capital, Vienna. We reached out to political analyst Mostafa Khoshchesh for his take on the ongoing talks of Vienna on the JCPOA revival. Let's have a listen to his comments.
Even those who were not sure about the real intentions of Washington have now come to agree with this view that the Americans are just looking for a zero-sum game. They just want to win concessions without making any kind of compromise. In the last few days, they've been showing a buyer's remorse, and they are running the table over again and again and again. And this is nothing new, you know. This is kind of a negotiation tactic of the United States. The American administration doesn't have the needed power and the needed flexibility to make a political decision. And by political decision, we mean compromise, given gives and takes. And Americans are just very much incapable of making the final decision, or they just pretend to be incapable. So they have been stonewalling the talks in the past 3 or 4 days.
Moscow condemns as provocative Western countries' repeated claims that Russia intends to attack Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman says predicting dates for invading Ukraine can have adverse consequences. Dmitry Peskov, however, says President Vladimir Putin takes no notice of such allegations. Despite repeated denials by Russia, the U.S. and its NATO allies insist on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. The latest such claim comes from the U.K.
All the signs are that the plan has already in some senses begun. That's what our American friends think, and you're seeing these provocations now in Donbass. You're starting to see this these explosions and so on that we've been warning about for a long time. And I'm afraid to say that the plan that we're seeing is for something that could be really the biggest war in Europe since 1945, in terms of sheer scale.
Have to use the tools that we have. And those tools,
Johnson says, sanctions on Russia will go much further than previously suggested in case it moves to invade Ukraine. He says that London and Washington will cut off Russian companies' access to U.S. dollars and British pounds if the Kremlin orders an attack. But Germany and Ukraine have pushed back against dire predictions. At a G7 meeting, the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, said it is inappropriate to resort to guessing or assuming what will happen. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has also said there is no need to panic. We've asked our Brussels correspondent, Jerome Hughes, with what European lawmakers make of the flare-up of tensions between Russia and the West.
It's more or less the same line that the West has been pushing in recent weeks since this sort of crisis escalated. And what basically the European Union, the United States, and the UK are saying is that Russia will effectively be cut off from the international financial system if there is an invasion of Ukraine. So, and it's that when we heard the debate being debated in the European Parliament, there were a sizable number of MEPs, members of the European Parliament, lawmakers, who were saying that this is just the wrong track to go down, that this constant anti-Russia rhetoric, which we've been seeing building up now for years and years, and these constant threats about the SWIFT system, which is, you know, effectively the international trading and currency system, to cut Russia off from SWIFT and so on. And it's the type of rhetoric that really has been unhelpful, according to many lawmakers. So we've seen an escalation in the threats. We've seen the likes of Joe Biden talking about making sure that the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project between Russia and Germany, that just will be scrapped if there's an invasion of Ukraine.
Joint celebrations break out in Bamako, the capital of Mali, over a planned withdrawal of French troops. French President Emmanuel Macron has said that his troops will leave Mali in an orderly fashion over 4 to 6 months. But Mali's ruling junta insists that a pullout needs to happen without delay. Relations between the two countries deteriorated sharply after Mali's army seized power in a coup in 2020. France currently has some 5,000 troops deployed across the Sahel, the majority of them in Mali. Paris says its troops are tasked with fighting militancy in the region, but Mali says the former colonial power intends to partition the country. Academic and journalist Mostafa Fitouri believes that the French military presence has worsened the security situation in Africa and will most likely continue to do so in the future.
I think the security situation in the Sahel region, extending from all the way to in the east to Sudan, is less stable, less secure than it was in 2013 when first France sent its troops to fight what it calls jihadists and terrorist groups. So the whole area has been, I wouldn't say mainly because of the French military intervention, but that was a contributing factor. The whole area has been destabilized much worse than it was. The number of attacks by terrorist groups has increased and has been a trans-border problem, not only in Mali, but we have seen it in Niger, we have seen it in Burkina Faso especially, where there has been a recent military takeover, mainly for this reason of lack of security. So the same problem is existing in Chad in a different form, and then all the way to Sudan, probably the contagion, the effect will continue.
Somalia's energy minister has angered top officials for signing a deal with a U.S. company to explore oil and gas off the country's coast. The Office for President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed says the agreement is null and void. It has also issued a decree banning any such agreements with foreign governments and entities during the election period. Prime Minister Mohamed Hossein Roble has also dismissed the agreement as illegal and unacceptable. He says that he will do whatever is needed to protect natural resources. Somalia is going through an election process that is more than a year overdue. It has also been marred by violence, including a Saturday attack in the central city of Beledweyne that killed 14 people. A close associate of disgraced U.S. billionaire Jeffrey Epstein has been found dead in his Paris prison cell. Jean-Luc Brunel had been charged with the rape of minors and held behind bars for more than a year. He denied those charges. Police are now investigating the cause of his death. The prominent modeling agent was closely linked to Epstein, the American convicted sex offender who was arrested in 2019. And Epstein, too, was found hanged in his New York jail cell while he was awaiting trial over the abuse against underage women. The case has also disgraced the British royal family. Just days ago, Queen Elizabeth's second son, Prince Andrew, settled a lawsuit brought against him by Virginia Roberts Giffrey. The woman claims Andrew abused her when she was a teenager after meeting him through Epstein. Nearly 1 month into Canada's protests against COVID restrictions, police say significant progress has been made in removing protesters from the streets of the capital, Ottawa.
Today we've made some very important progress in safely removing this unlawful protest from our streets. At every step in this operation, we've been upfront and clear with the unlawful protesters that they must leave the area. We've advised them of our enforcement efforts so they could continue to make informed decisions. We've backed up those warnings with a deliberate and methodical operation using lawful and safe tactics.
The official added that police at some point had to use horses, helmets, and batons to secure the safety of officers. Ottawa Police Chief has called on all the protesters remaining on the streets to go home. Earlier in the day, police clashed with protesters in the city using pepper spray and stun grenades to disperse them. So far, more than 140 people have been arrested and dozens of vehicles seized over the past 2 days. Organizers of the so-called Freedom Convoy say that they have asked truckers to withdraw because of the heavy-handed police tactics. The massive crackdown comes after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to deal with the protesters. The demonstrations initially started in January by Canadian truckers who are opposed to rules that require unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. But the protests have now turned into a rallying point for all people who are in some way opposed to the policies of Trudeau's government. In Brazil, search and rescue operations continue as nearly 200 people are still unaccounted for in the wake of devastating floods and landslides. Rescue workers pulled more bodies Saturday from the muddy wreckage and rubble in the city of Petrópolis, where the death toll has risen to 146. Meanwhile, bad weather hampered the search for survivors, and emergency teams had to suspend their work several times. Over 900 people have been housed in schools and shelters. With the search now in its fifth day, authorities say that there is little hope of finding more survivors. Teams of volunteers are also helping with search and rescue efforts. Tuesday's rainfall exceeded the average for the whole of February, triggering landslides and floods in Petrópolis, that is a popular tourist getaway that is north of Rio de Janeiro. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. This is bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Gulf of Mexico, still recovering from an estimated 134 million gallons of oil spilled by BP in 2010, the Biden administration has leased record-breaking offshore drilling rights to 33 gas and oil companies, including ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Chevron. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Ripton, political writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden issues more gas and oil drilling permits than Trump in his first year. Here's the story. Biden came to the presidency promising swift action on climate change. A year in office, it is critical to see what he has accomplished beyond rejoining the Paris Agreement. Despite campaign promises to halt gas and oil drilling on public lands, Biden has issued more drilling permits on federal lands than Donald Trump did in his first year. In the Gulf of Mexico, still recovering from an estimated 134 million gallons of oil spilled by BP in 2010, the Biden administration has leased record-breaking offshore drilling rights to 33 gas and oil companies, including ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and Chevron. The 308 leased tracts in the Mexico Gulf cover 1.7 million of more than 80 million acres that the administration opened to auction in November 2021, the largest lease sale in the history of the country. While it is true that the Biden issued a moratorium on gas and oil drilling on public lands in his first month in office, it was blocked in the federal court. Attorneys general from 13 Republican states led by Louisiana successfully challenged the moratorium, effectively blocking it. U.S. District Judge Terry Doughty, a Trump appointee, ruled that the states would suffer job losses and other injury if the moratorium remained in force. He ordered the Biden administration to go forward with lease sales. Though the Interior Department appealed Doughty's decision, it nevertheless held the lease sales in November. Environmentalists condemned the auction of the offshore drilling rights in the Gulf of Mexico. Representing environmental interests, Earth Justice attorney Bretty Hardy warned that the auction of the Gulf of Mexico lease sales is basically a giveaway to industry of millions of acres of the Gulf of Mexico so they can lock in production for years, at a time when we need to be shifting away from fossil fuel development. Other critics, including some Democrats, said that the administration should have reviewed how the sale would affect climate change and held off the sale while the ruling was under appeal. The November sale of leases in the Gulf of Mexico came on the heels of the Glasgow COP26 negotiations to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. In Glasgow, President Biden acknowledged the gravity of climate change and the international community's need to act quickly. "This is a decisive decade in which we have an opportunity to prove ourselves. If we commit to doing our part of each of our nations with determination and with the ambition, that's what COP26 is all about." Yet the Gulf of Mexico leases make it difficult, if not impossible, to reach the administration's stated goal of limiting U.S. greenhouse gas emissions to 50 to 52% of the 2005 levels by 2030. Drilling gas and oil in the Gulf of Mexico makes up 20% of the carbon released on leased federal lands and waters. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that the U.S. discharged 6,558 metric tons of carbon in 2019, roughly 15% of the total world CO2 emissions. Even the economics of climate change calls for swift action. According to energy researchers at Princeton University, it will cost between $7.8 trillion and $13.9 trillion to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050. To get to a total of $10 trillion investment over this period, the government needs to spend roughly $370 billion a year on clean energy. In his Build Back Better bill, Biden proposed $555 billion to combat climate change over the rest of the decade. But Senator Joe Manchin objected to the money for clean energy, forcing Biden to cut the monies for mitigating the worst effects of the climate change. With an estimated personal investment of $1 to $5 million in his coal brokerage business and hundreds of thousands of dollars donated to his office by energy corporations, Senator Manchin refuses to support any appropriations for clean energy. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains the second largest producer of greenhouse gas in the world. If left unchecked, the cost to the nation of greenhouse gases may total $14.5 trillion by 2070, according to Deloitte, an organization that tracks the global carbon footprint. In late January 2022, the Biden administration sale of Gulf of Mexico gas and oil leases were roundly rejected in court. Federal Judge Rodolfo Contreras ruled that the Biden administration had acted arbitrarily and capriciously in the sale of leases for 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico. He canceled the sales, ruling that the administration had not sufficiently considered the sales' effect on climate change. Environmental groups also fault the Interior Department for using an outdated analysis that found that no greenhouse gases would be emitted from the production of oil and gas in the Gulf of Mexico. They call for a new analysis that examines the broader impact of burning these fossil fuels on climate change. They point out that 25% of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions are from burning fossil fuels produced on public lands and in federal waters. Judge Contreras also ruled that the auction of lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico violated the 1970 National Environmental Policy Act. It stipulates that the government must consider the environmental impact of drilling and construction projects before it auctions off leases. According to the Washington Post, the Biden administration nevertheless plans to auction off 200,000 acres to the fossil fuel industry in western states by the end of March. An additional 1 million acres of lease sales in the Cook Inlet in Alaska will also be auctioned off after the March sale. These sales egregiously contradict Biden's campaign promise of no more drilling on federal lands, period. The fossil fuel industry, for its part, argues that the added production in the Gulf of Mexico will keep down gas and oil prices and contribute to the nation's energy security. This argument is politically palatable to an administration now wary of inflation criticism from Republicans and upcoming interim elections. At the same time, though, the fossil fuel industry's assessment ignores the signs of climate change. If greenhouse gases are not dramatically curbed, climate change models predict that average global temperature will rise 4 degrees Celsius, that is 4.2 degrees Fahrenheit, over the rest of the country, while scientists generally agree that an increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, must be the goal to avoid the most catastrophic climate events. The U.S. and global community of nations must adopt clean energy standards as soon as possible. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Energy, IPCC, in its 2021 report illustrates how imperative immediate action is. In this report, the sixth assessment it has issued since 1988, it highlights five essential observations based on scientific review of the growing body of literature on climate change. Climate change is indisputably human-caused. 2010 to 2020 was the hottest decade in 125,000 years. Certain changes we've already seen are irreversible. Greenhouse gas emissions are the leading cause of the climate change, and climate events are increasing in severity and number in any region of the planet. Frequent natural disasters in the U.S. have been on an upward trend since 1980, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. In the first decade of record-breaking, the total of cost of natural disaster was about $700 billion, or $70 billion in annual average. In most recent decade, however, the costs have escalated to roughly 2 $1.9 billion. These calculations make it quite clear that natural disasters in the United States may seem equal Biden's proposed clean energy expenditures of $555 billion.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. We follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, fresh water springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country. And their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower Saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens, the lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Esfandiar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people too hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain, but there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems, but Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.